We have a weird homicide.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
The police released their only suspect in the mass murder of film star Sharon Tate and four others.
Late last night, another bizarre murder in Los Angeles, the second in 2 days. The owner of a small supermarket chain found in his home, his head covered by a white hood, a meat fork stuck in his chest. His wife, 38-year-old Mrs. Lino LaBianca, found in the bedroom dead, her back brutally cut by a whip.
He's inside, two bodies outside.
They came and went, and the number varied from 20 to 30. Police said they were a pseudo-religious cult. People who worked on the ranch said they were heavy users of drugs.
Were lurid. The movie actress was Sharon Tate, 26. The others were a male hairdresser, the heiress to a coffee fortune, a writer, and a boy just out of high school.
A wandering band of members of a so-called religious cult with a leader they call Jesus has had three of its followers arrested in the investigation of the murder of Sharon Tate and six others. Those arrested are two women and one man, and the Los Angeles police said they would ask murder indictments against several others. Five women are being held as material witnesses.
They called themselves the family.
Los Angeles has had another multiple murder. Last night, a middle-aged couple was stabbed to death in a case that has striking similarities to the mass murder Saturday of actress Sharon Tate and four friends.
Only taking dope and stealing cars and they just sit around all day and sleep, and that's about it. And went around collecting garbage and had that for dinner and went to the store once in a while, and that was about it. They just slept and got loaded.
People who lived with Manson on the ranch and in the desert denied that they were a violent group. They called themselves the family.
Who's playing? That's what the whole thing is, that all we was doing out there was playing.
Well, what kind of guy was Charlie?
He's a good person. A very good person. He's got a lot of peace.
Was he out there all the time?
I don't even know. You know, he'd take off over mountains, just like deer.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
On his body, the word war had been carved in the chest. Then, with blood, the killer had scrawled on the refrigerator door the words, death to pigs.
Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, best-selling author Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our 11th look at Charles Manson and his family. Before we get into this week's case, as always, I have my normal plugs and show notes. If you're interested in following me on any form of social media, just search for either Ian Totten, author, The Deathcast, or Corpse Creek Publishing. If you're interested in signing up for the show's mailing list, you can go to corpsecreekpublishing.com, click on the sign up button. I don't often send out emails, but on occasion I will send out something concerning either my written works or this podcast. While you're there, please consider making a donation to the show by clicking on the Donate Now button. Buy me a cup of coffee or a pack of cigarettes. No amount is too small, and of course, no amount is too large. If you really enjoy what I do, there's a couple ways that you can help out with this. First and foremost is you can go to wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts. Hit the subscribe button. Leave a 5-star review. If you leave a written 5-star review, I will read it out on air. If you leave me a crappy review just because you're one of those faceless keyboard warriors who likes to hide behind an assumed online name, rest assured, I will give you a shout-out on the show, too. However, I will give out your real name, because that's just how I roll. Another way you can help out the show is after subscribing and leaving your review, share the show on social media. And lastly, go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon. For as little as $2 a month, you can help with the production of this show. You know, I've been saying it, there are Patreon-only episodes that are coming, and in fact, they will be out as soon as I finish with this Manson series. Alright, so that's it for the plugs this week. If you get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, the trials of Charles Manson and his followers were underway for both the Sharon Tate murders and the murder of the LaBiancas. It really isn't an understatement to say that the trials were an absolute media circus, a complete shit show, if you will. Starting with Manson attempting to represent himself and then doing such unique things as carving an X into his head, which later became a swastika, and Manson's followers, both those who were on trial with him as well as those who were free following suit. It went further than that, however. Manson ended up shaving his head while he was on trial, and his followers, all of them, quickly followed suit with this as well. There is footage out there of Manson's followers, those who were free, out on the sidewalks in front of the courthouse, singing and holding their own small forms of protest. And it continued to go in this manner. One thing that is important to note concerning the crimes is that the prosecutors tried all of them as a group for the most part, and the reason for this was they needed the others, meaning Susan Atkins, Cromwinkle, etc., to prove that there was a conspiracy to murder these individuals and that the orders had come down from Manson. I talked briefly last week about how there was a lot of witness testimony that Vincent Bagliosi intentionally kept from the trial, which may have implicated other individuals being involved in these crimes beyond Manson and his handful of followers. Some of the individuals who were left off would have been able to give evidence that Manson was in contact with individuals who were known to be assets of the CIA as well as the FBI. This isn't, you know, a conspiracy theory in and of itself. This has actually been proven and verified in the book Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 1960s. The author of that book tracked down as many of these individuals as he was able to. Further, if you look into Ed Sanders' book, The Family, which was about Charles Manson and his followers and was done with firsthand research of Sanders actually going and living with members of the family during and around the period of the trials, there's very little mention of the entire BS helter-skelter motive that the prosecutors put on. As the trials wended their way forward, however, Manson's followers took on the defense that they had only committed the crimes at Manson's behest, which he saw as a betrayal. I think one of the most interesting points of the entire trial for me is the fact that Leslie Van Houten was only charged for the murders of the LaBiancas, but further, she went through numerous different defense attorneys. We are going to discuss briefly some of the things that occurred with these defense attorneys. One of the attorneys was a man by the name of Ronald Hughes, who first met with Manson during December of 1969. Initially, he was assigned as Charles Manson's attorney before eventually being replaced by Irving Kanarik. This was about 2 weeks before the trial. I've read some reports that state that this was because he found Manson to be uncontrollable and realized that he could not mount a sufficient defense for him. Hughes ended up defending Leslie Van Houten for her part in the LaBianca murders. Hughes was called at the time in the media the hippie lawyer because he had a fairly decent understanding of the hippie subculture. Some sources state that he had participated in the hippie lifestyle for a period of time. Others that he had just been around it enough to understand, you know, what it was that they believed in, as well as in how much drugs were a part of this counterculture. This can be shown by his rather aggressive cross-examination of Linda Kasabian, where he attacked her for her use of hallucinogenics and her experiencing vibrations coming from Manson, which she felt were attuned to her soul. One notable thing that Hughes attempted to do was try and separate Van Houten's trial from those of Manson and Watson and the rest. Hughes contended that during the time of the murder, specifically the LaBianca crimes, Leslie was under the complete control of Manson. This was due to the amount of LSD and other illicit drugs that were frequently imbued within the family. And there is some basis for this. Without digging into a whole can of worms, it is known that during the MK Ultra experiments that the CIA conducted, a lot of research was put into LSD as a agent to control enemies. And enough of the defense team believed this that they eventually were able to convince the women who were on trial with Manson to stop mimicking his various outlandish actions, such as the carving of the X's into the forehead and the shaving of the head, as it was making it apparent to the jury as well as the prosecution that, yes, they were in fact guilty as sin and would do anything that Manson did and or commanded of them. It has been stated that this attempt by Hughes to separate Van Houten from him angered Manson greatly, as Manson's plan was to have those who had committed the crimes implicate themselves and completely clear Manson of his involvement in the murders. During the course of the trial, there were numerous bursts from the co-defendants, and about 22 weeks in, the prosecution rested their case, at which point, much to the shock of the courtroom, the defense also rested their case, at which point Van Houten, Atkins, and Cromwinkel began to make a scene, declaring that they demanded to testify, as it was their hope and goal to clear Manson of any involvement within the crimes. Apparently, Hughes became enraged by this and informed the court that he quote-unquote refused to take part in any defense which would push his client out the window. After all of this happened, Manson made a statement to the court Some places you'll see that this is referred to as his testimony, but it really wasn't a testimony, as Manson was not cross-examined by either the defense or the prosecution. I'm going to read a little bit of Manson's testimony here. Quote, "There's been a lot of charges and a lot of things said about me and brought against the co-defendants in this case, of which a lot could be cleared up and clarified. I never went to school, so I never growed up to read and write too good. So I've stayed in jail, and I have stayed stupid, and I have stayed a child while I have watched your world grow up. And then I look at the things that you do, and I don't understand. You eat meat, and you kill things that are better than you are, and then you say how bad, and even killers, your children are. You made your children what they are. These children that come at you with knives, they are your children. You taught them. I didn't teach them. I just tried to help them stand up. Most of the people at the ranch that you call the family were just people that you did not want. People that were alongside the road that their parents had kicked out, that did not want to go to juvenile hall. So I did the best I could, and I took them up on my garbage dump, and I told them this, that in love there is no wrong. I told them that anything they do for their brothers and sisters is good if they do it with a good thought. I was working at cleaning up my house, something that Nixon should have been doing. He should have been on the side of the road picking up his children, but he wasn't. He was in the White House sending them off to war. I don't understand you, but I don't try. I don't try to judge nobody. I know that the only person I can judge is me. But I know this, that in your hearts and your own souls, you are as much responsible for the Vietnam War as I am for killing these people. I can't judge any of you. I have no malice against you and no ribbons for you, but I think that is high time that you all start looking at yourselves and judging the lie that you live in. I can't dislike you, but I will say this to you. You haven't got long before you all are all going to kill yourselves because you are all crazy. And you can project it back at me, but I am only what lives inside each and every one of you. My father is the jailhouse. My father is your system. I am only what you made me. I am only a reflection of you." Manson went on at some great length, basically spinning words to take the blame for what had happened off of himself. And there was some truth within his words in that he was a product of the system. If you remember from episode 3 where I discussed Manson's early life, he was in and out of juvenile halls, jails, and prisons for the majority of his life prior to the murders, and had even asked to not be released back before the start of the family, a request which was denied. After Manson gave this testimony to the closed court meaning there was no jury present, Manson was asked as to whether or not he would like to give this testimony in front of the jury, which Manson decided not to do. After this, the judge called a 10-day recess to allow both sides to prepare for their closing arguments. Now, during this 10-day recess, something unique happened. On November 27th of 1970, Van Houten's attorney, Ronald Hughes, decided to go on a camping trip to a remote area in Ventura County. He was accompanied by James Forsher and Lauren Elder. During the trip, flash floods occurred, with Forsher and Elder hitchhiking their way out of the area, while Hughes himself decided to stay at least until November 29th. Hughes was last seen by other campers on the morning of November 28th. When court reconvened on November 30th, Hughes was nowhere to be found. When December 2nd rolled around and Hughes had still not appeared, the judge decided that the trial should continue and gave Van Houten a new lawyer by the name of Maxwell Keith. at which point all of the women who were on trial demanded that the defense be allowed to be reopened, and demand that was denied by the judge. Manson and his followers decided to create a disturbance in the courthouse prior to the opening of closing statements by suggestion that the judge himself had gotten rid of Ronald Hughes. At which point, Manson and his followers were removed from the courthouse. On March 29th of 1971, Manson and his followers were all convicted of murder. During the sentencing phase, the women who had been convicted along with Manson attempted to exonerate him by giving stories about how they had all been violent prior to meeting him, with Van Houten stating that she would have been convicted of manslaughter or murder with a deadly weapon whether she had met him or not. On March 29th of 1971, the jury returned death sentences for all involved in the crimes. On this same day, Van Houten's former lawyer, Ronald Hughes, was found. His body, which was badly decomposed, was found in Ventura County, wedged between two boulders within a gorge. And because of this, a cause of death was never able to be determined. Vincent Bagliosi, remember, the prosecutor for the Los Angeles County, later stated in the book that he wrote, Helter Skelter, that Sandra Good, who was an associate of the family, claimed that members of the family had killed 35 to 40 different people, and Hughes was just the first of the retaliatory murders. I have read other accounts that have stated that Manson was enraged over how Hughes was defending Van Houten and trying to distance her from him, and that he had ordered the man's murder, although whether or not this is true, we will likely never know for certain. After being sentenced to death, the perpetrators were sent to their respective prisons. This was until the California Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty was unconstitutional, at which point all members of the family had their sentences converted to life terms. However, in 1976, Leslie Van Houten had her conviction overturned, after which she was able to prove that she had been denied proper legal counsel after the disappearance of Hughes. This resulted in Leslie Van Houten being released from prison on a $200,000 bond. A retrial was ordered, which resulted in a hung jury. Obviously, the state of California was not going to let this stand, so they ordered another retrial of Van Houten, and she was convicted of first-degree murder along with conspiracy in the Tate murders and sentenced to 7 years to life in prison. This isn't the end of the story, however, because even after Manson's conviction, the family continued for a few years. I've even read reports that the family continues to this day. Notable instances involving members of the family really do revolve around Lynette Squeaky Frome. In 1972, she traveled with Priscilla Cooper, Nancy Pittman, and at least two members of the Aryan Brotherhood. In November of 72, this group met James and Lauren Willett in a cabin. Members of the Aryan Brotherhood forced James Willett to dig his own grave before shooting him. His wife was also murdered, at which time the group left the area. Eventually, the body of James would be found with his hands sticking out of the ground, and Lauren's body was discovered in the basement. The individuals in this group were arrested, although Frome would eventually be released due to a lack of evidence. There were conflicting stories given as to how the individuals died, but the police discounted these as being untruthful. We will be back in just a moment. From author Alistair Cross comes the Vampires of Crimson Cove series. When the sun goes down and the fog rolls in, the darkness comes out to play in the little town of Crimson Cove. By day, it's an idyllic mountain village, but after sunset, stay inside and lock your doors. Between dusk and dawn, the streets run red with blood. Two brothers, Brooks and Cade Coulter, know all about the darkness. One fights it, and the other is part of it. And although he tries to stay on the side of light, can you ever really trust a vampire? This is what New York Times best-selling author of the Walking Dead series, Jay Bonansinga, has to say. Put Bram Stoker in a giant cocktail shaker. Add a pinch of Laura K. Hamilton, a shot of John Carpenter, and a healthy jigger of absinthe, and you'll end up with Alistair Cross's modern gothic chiller, The Crimson Corset, a deliciously terrifying tale that will sink its teeth into you from page one. The Vampires of Crimson Cove series is available on Amazon in paperback, ebook, and Audible. Also available on Kindle Unlimited. We are back. Remember, it's the Vampires of Crimson Cove series by Alistair Cross. Find it on Amazon. After leaving Stockton, Frome moved into an apartment in Sacramento with Sandra Good. This in order to be closer to where Manson was being held at the time. On September 5th of 1975, Frome went to Capitol Park in Sacramento. Unbeknownst to those who were also gathered for the president's speech, Frome was armed with a Colt M1911 45 caliber semi-automatic pistol. Frome pulled the gun on Ford, unaware that there was no round within the chamber, and this likely saved the president's life. And eventually, she would be convicted from this, which landed her with a life sentence under a 1965 law that made attempted assassination of the president a capital crime. To the best of my knowledge, she has never renounced her belief in Manson. Eventually, Frome would be released from prison. This in August of 2009. Frome has given a few interviews, one of which she stated that she was still in love with Manson. And in 2018, she released a book about her time with Manson entitled Reflection, which can be found pretty much anywhere you get books at. As for Manson's other followers who were convicted, the majority of them ended up realizing the error of their way and converting to Christianity while they were incarcerated, with a few of them, most notably Leslie Van Houten, going on to get numerous degrees. And it's important to note that all of them have repented and shown remorse for their crimes. However, Clem Brogan, who helped police find Shorty Shay's remains, is the only one to have been paroled. This happened in 1985. And I'm going to throw out my personal thoughts on all of this at this point in time. Manson's followers who continue to be incarcerated are not incarcerated for the crimes that they committed. They are still incarcerated because of who they committed. There have been thousands of murderers in the state of California who have done just as heinous a crime as Manson and his followers were convicted, who have been released. Patricia Cromwinkle, Leslie Van Houten, Susan Atkins, all of them have continued to be kept in prison because they dared to attack a celebrity. I know there's people out there that are going to disagree with me on that. That's okay. That's your opinion. This is my opinion. This is my show. So shut up and listen. Had they gone and committed this crime at the house of someone who was less well-to-do or was not known, they very well likely would have been released in the 1980s, if not the 1990s. But because of the power behind the Tate and Polanski names and the fact that the media, which is centered in Hollywood, has painted this unrealistic and untrue portrait of who Sharon Tate was, and has continued to push this narrative that she was this megastar who was beloved by all, and that her death devastated Hollywood. California legal system has decided that they need to pay for this crime because they dared to attack the institution of celebrity. Again, you can disagree with that, but you can go and look for yourself and see the thousands of individuals who have been committed of heinous crimes in the state of California. We're talking murders, rapes, assaults on children who have been released after serving a period of their sentence. However, when someone goes and commits a crime against a celebrity in the state of California, the book is thrown at them. It's not hyperbole, that's fact. And because of how unusual the case was, the fact that it involved the wife of a man who would go on to become one of the most well-regarded directors in history, and the attention paid to it by the media, none of them will ever be released. And I give you an example of that. Susan Atkins was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. Oftentimes, when an inmate is diagnosed with a terminal illness, they petition a court for clemency based on grounds of compassion. Many times they are released in order to go spend their few remaining days or months or years with their family. Susan Atkins was denied this, stating the heinousness of the crimes that she had committed. Reality is the crimes that she committed attacked the entertainment industry, and that's why they kept her locked up away from her family in a prison medical facility. All of Manson's followers who are locked up have proven themselves to be upstanding prisoners who would be nothing if not a boon to their communities. And in fact, many of them have been recommended for parole numerous times, only to have the governor of California, who is beholden to the entertainment industry, as well as to the Tate family, the most recent that I am aware of being Leslie Van Houten, who has proven time and again that she is not a danger to society in any way, shape, or form. She has been denied parole by that dipshit Gavin Newsom in California, I don't know how many times. And it has nothing to do with, again, the crimes that they committed, but who they committed the crimes against. Had this crime not been splashed all over world papers and television shows for the last 50 some odd years, they wouldn't be out. Manson's a different story. His followers are not. I am a firm believer that the individuals who committed these crimes, while heinous, were not in their right frame of mind when the crimes were committed. They were all burned out on massive amounts of drugs, including LSD, marijuana, cocaine, you name it. All of these drugs in thousands of cases throughout the years have been shown to affect a person's ability to differentiate between right or wrong, meaning that it affects their judgment. Now, you take people who have been living with Manson for a year or two and were constantly under the influence of LSD. They've got a very charismatic man there telling them things that they're believing because of their use of drugs. He suggests they go out and commit these crimes. They go out and do it. My personal opinion, yes, they should be held liable for that, but there needs to be a limit on how long they're held liable for those crimes, especially given the changes that these individuals have made in their lives. It is obvious to anyone who has followed the case that the women, as well as Tex Watson and the others, are rehabilitated because they no longer have access to the mind-altering substances that they were using during the commission of the crimes, but more so because of how well they have turned their lives around while incarcerated. I believe Tex Watson is now a prison minister. As stated, Leslie Van Houten has numerous degrees. Most of those who were involved in the commission of these crimes hold degrees and counsel other inmates from the inside. And it's high time that they be released. A prison sentence in America, when given a life term, generally is about 25 years, after which they review the individual, and if it's found that they are, you know, rehabilitated, no longer pose a threat to society, they're released. That is not an opinion on my part. That's the facts of the matter in reality. You can look it up for yourselves. But they haven't been released, and it's simply because of who they killed as opposed to what they did. All right, that rant is over with. We're going to move on to Manson. A cult of personality sprung up around Manson after his conviction, with people writing books. Manson himself wrote a book, women trying to marry him so they could have access to his body after he died. He was continuously moved around to various state institutions within California, giving bizarre interviews with various media personalities. I remember back in the early 90s, there was an interview that came out, and my mother let me watch it. And at this point, Manson had been incarcerated for, let's say, 20-some-odd years. And watching them, you could tell that, A, he was batshit crazy, but you could also see the charisma that came off of him. At this point in time, Manson had converted the X that was carved into his forehead into a swastika. And I remember distinctly him sitting there, and every time he was addressing the interviewer, it was, "You understand what I mean, woman?" This kind of thing. You can find clips of these interviews online. I mean, it was something to behold. It was almost like watching performance art. And part of me wonders if that is not what it was. We've got to remember, Charles Manson was a very small guy. Easy pickings in prison. He was also an extremely high-profile offender, which ups the ante of him being assaulted with in prison. Few things that happened to Manson while he was incarcerated. On September 25th of 1984, Manson had paint thinner poured on him and he was set on fire, causing second and third degree burns over 20% of his body. He was found to have been trafficking drugs while in prison, as well as in possession of a cell phone. On January 1st of 2017, Manson, who was being held at the Corcoran Prison, was taken to the Mercy Hospital due to gastrointestinal bleeding. At that point, it was stated that Manson was too weak for surgery, although he was returned to prison on January 6th. Over the following few months, Manson was said to have been in and out of the hospital. On November 19th of 2017, Manson went into cardiac arrest as a symptom of colon cancer, dying at the age of 83. After his death, there were numerous fights over his estate as well as his remains, and eventually one of Manson's grandsons by the name of Jason Freeman was given possession of Manson's body. This was in 2018. Manson's estate is still being battled over in court. This, I imagine, from at least one side, is an attempt by an individual to get the commercial copyrights on Manson under their control so they can make money from it. While I imagine that Manson's grandson Freeman probably wants to remove them from the public so that people cannot financially benefit from the use of Manson's name, image, or music. It should be noted that Freeman, unlike the others who were vying for control of his remains, did have Manson's body cremated, thus keeping anyone from building a shrine to Manson where his remains were resting. Prosecutor Vince Bagliosi, on the other hand, ended up dying June 6th of 2015. So, there it is, our exploration of Charles Manson and his family. Again, as I stated in the first episode and numerous times throughout, there's a lot of stuff that I left out just because this is such an all-encompassing case. And I encourage anyone who really has an interest in learning a more detailed analysis of Charles Manson to go check out some of the books out there. Leave Helter Skelter because it's absolute rubbish, spun by the prosecutor in an effort to make a profit. I say that because it's known that Bagliosi had a book deal in the works even before the trials began. Check out Ed Sanders' The Family. I know it's kind of a pricey book, but it really is worth reading. Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, the Secret History of the 60s, Manson in His Own Words, Tex Watson's Cease to Exist, Susan Atkins' The Myth of Helter Skelter, as well as Child of Satan, Child of God, Her Own Story, also by Susan Atkins. Be aware before you go into researching it, however, that there are a lot of conspiracies connected to Charles Manson, and other than possible ties to the CIA via Manson's time in prison and his former parole officers' alleged ties to to the CIA, there isn't a whole lot out there to substantiate any of the claims in those other books that you will invariably come across, because Manson has become an industry in and of himself, and everybody is interested in writing a book about him and making some money. So, there you go. I hope you enjoyed the series. The Deathcast will be taking a break for a week or two while I prepare to dive into our next series. Moving forward with the show, that is really what I'm going to be aiming to do, is these long, deep dive episodes on a particular case, because that seems to be what my audience enjoys, and I enjoy doing that way as well, because I can focus all of my attention and energies on just one case. I'm not trying to cover, you know, 7 or 8 different cases at a clip doing research on all of them at one time. I can just focus on one case and move forward with that. That being said, the Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creep Publishing. Until next time, stay morbid.